If it's nerdy, we're into it.
Gaming, movies, television, wrestling, comics, whatever. We are Kyle Eckert and Chris Heck, two lifelong friends with a passion for the world of geekery.
And this is the Geek Ketchup Podcast.
What's good, Geek Ketchup family? I'm Kyle Eckert.
And I'm Chris Heck.
And you are listening to Season 2, Chapter 26, the first of our two-part discussion on the recent Marvel's X-Men, Ten of Swords, or X of Swords crossover event. We've got a ton to cover, but before we get there, we want to take a moment, as always, to say thank you for listening and to send our appreciation your way for spending your time with us. If you've enjoyed Geek Ketchup, be sure to subscribe to the podcast so you get every single one of our new chapters. And to help spread the love for the world of geekery, please share us with your friends and family. If you haven't followed us on social media already, you can find us at Geek Ketchup Podcast on Facebook and YouTube, at Geek Ketchup Pod on Instagram and Twitter. All of these links for our accounts are available on our website, geekketchuppodcast.com. There's even a link to our Patreon page if you'd like to support the show. Now, on to the good stuff. For those of you that have been listening to us since the beginning, you know that Chris and I have been keeping up with the current era of X-Men and mutant kind, the era known as the Dawn of X. For any newcomers, hit pause, go and check out chapters 1, 8, 13, and 18 for our complete thoughts, or let me get you caught up as quickly as I can. Beginning in the summer of 2019, Marvel completely relaunched all X-Men-related books with the dual series event House of X and Powers of X. This event established many new norms for all mutants, hero and villain, uniting them on the living island of Krakoa. But despite mutants finally putting their own differences aside, not all was well. New threats arose in the form of human governments, biological weapons, intergalactic, and otherworldly civilizations. It's those otherworldly threats that brought mutants to the conflict they faced in the 22-part crossover Ten of Swords. Chris and I plan to bring you a complete breakdown of each issue in this massive event that included every single active X-Men series Marvel is currently publishing in some way. From X-Men, X-Force, X-Factor, Marauders, Hellions, Cable, New Mutants, Wolverine, and possibly the biggest player, Excalibur. Here in part one of our discussion, we'll cover up until the halfway mark, which is part 11 of X of Swords Stasis. Then in part two, we'll hit the second half. And of course, I'll go ahead and say it now, this is your spoiler warning. With that, let's dive right into the action of Excalibur 12, which was the prelude to X of Swords, Ten of Swords. We're going to say it interchangeably all day here, folks. It is Ten of Swords, but we may say X of Swords just because that is how it's written. So, in Excalibur 12, the prelude, Apocalypse is gathering the High Lords, which are essentially the earliest mutants known to Earth, to open the external gate. And what they didn't know is that he was prepared to sacrifice them to open this gate that takes you to Otherworld and the Citadel.
Yeah, it was kind of an interesting issue there. Not as much happened as I was expecting, being that it was the prelude, but it was really cool to see them with the High Lords. I think they called them the Externals, and they were essentially the six other ancients that, you know, match up with Apocalypse and have been running around behind the scenes since, you know, I guess the dawn of time. But it was also a little bit of a culmination of a lot of what Apocalypse has been doing in the Excalibur series since issue one. So that was kind of cool to see as someone who's been following that series, simply because all along we've just been getting these little tidbits of what he's been doing. There's been a lot of mystery there. He doesn't give a whole lot of information. And so, you know, the way they came out with this, and, you know, he's fulfilling his plan, he kills them. He shows that they can be, you know, their life force can essentially be transferred to other mutants. And he does that with Richter and some of the other folks that have been running around with Excalibur. I guess we'll have to see exactly how all that pays off in the end or how that affects things moving forward. But really, the goal there was getting that crystal gate built to Otherworld, because that was one of his biggest goals throughout the whole series was he wants these contact points so he can freely travel to and from some of these other worlds. And I guess, you know, they will all fit into his schemes.
Right. And I actually, my biggest takeaway from this particular issue was, is Apocalypse finally going into business for himself? Like, he's been manipulating things all behind the scenes, but he's been playing along with Krakoa. And is it finally, he's gotten it to the point where he's going to enact his plans for mutant kind. Like, he's been part of the council, he's been part of the crew, but now it's really what I want to get back to doing.
Yeah.
And that's really what I saw here. He manipulated these externals, sucked their life force, opened this gate, which is a second gate, because there is the first smaller gate that takes him directly to the Kingdom of Avalon.
Right.
Which happened also in Excalibur. And that's actually going to be a common theme here, is for a long time in these X books, I kind of threw shade at Excalibur that it was happening on the fringe, that the events of Excalibur and what Apocalypse was doing behind the scenes wasn't impacting the main story
right.
for mutants, and X of Swords and has kind of changed all of this on me.
Yeah, it was a sleeper, and I know we touched on it a little bit, and I kept saying as we were breaking down the individual issues through Dawn of X that something was going on here, and it felt like it was going to lead up to something big. I definitely did not expect it to be kind of like the direct lead up to this event, so that payoff, I feel like, has kind of turned out to be a little bigger than I anticipated. But it has been really cool. You know, Apocalypse has always got big stuff going on. He's been around for thousands and thousands of years. You know, essentially all the mutants are his children. So he's one of those characters where he's, you know, he's a bad guy, but he also has really strong ties to the mutants. Whether he's fighting them or working with them, he still seems to have this weird, you know, love or connection for them, even if they hate him. And so that dynamic has continued to play out in Excalibur, and, you know, even Xavier and Magneto and the other members of the Quiet Council don't truly know what he's doing. They're just kind of letting him do it.
Right.
And so I think we'll see some of that stuff really bubble up here as we get into the actual Ten of Swords events, because there were, for me, as an Excalibur follower, I felt some payoffs as far as the things that he's been building to now starting to come into view as we got into the books here.
Yeah, absolutely. And we're going to just go ahead and we'll jump into X of Swords creation. And that was the opening issue, the true part one, where we saw basically the opening of this issue took us to the kingdom of Dryador. I'm not sure how you were saying it in your head, Chris, but I was kind of saying like Dryador in the other world, where we see Apocalypse's original four horsemen about to lay siege to a watchtower there. And it kind of kicks off this whole event, tying everything together. And of course, a messenger rushes to Opal Saturnine at the Citadel and basically to inform her immediately that Akoa, the other half of Krakoa, we covered that in our previous chapter, that we found out that what was once one island was cleaved in two by the Twilight Sword. And so all of this is really starting to tie back together. So Apocalypse is standing before the Quiet Council, answering for essentially his crimes of opening up this external gate, because he's always been operating about number one. Way, even if his secondary stories have aligned with what the mutants want to do, at the end of the day, he's always about number one. So he's opened this external gate and made this connection. And essentially, he has told the Quiet Council that he sent Summoner, Banshee, and Eunice through the gate on his behalf. And now they are sent trapped there. So they need to develop an away team to go rescue these mutants. And of course, they do. They put together a small team of Beast, Angel, Havoc, Polaris, Monet, and Rockslide, all agreeing to go into Otherworld to get them back. And Chris, things do not go well from there.
No. And one thing you got to keep in mind with Apocalypse and the deal with the Quiet Council is that a lot of these events are things that are literally thousands of years in the making. So you mentioned seeing his four horsemen, and even though he doesn't know it at the time, but those events are really things that were put into motion before Charles Xavier existed, before Magneto existed, before Storm existed, you know? I think it's one of those stories where Apocalypse kind of knows the end game, even though everybody else doesn't. He knows the greater need for what's about to happen, or maybe something tied to Krakoa. So even though the Quiet Council kind of gives him some some pushback. They aren't certain about what he's doing or sending a whole nother team into Otherworld. They kind of still go along with it, and it has this kind of smell of fate to it. You know, like no matter what they do or they decide, this is happening, this is in motion, you know, and there's a threat coming. So I thought that what we saw when they sent the teams over and really kind of what happened there as a part of that was a game changer, though. And so I don't know if you want to get into it here, but, you know, when they send the team over and the army, the Dark Army and everything is coming and they confront them, they ultimately get put in a position that they never expected to, you know, going back to when Krakoa was formed.
Oh, yeah, they immediately get almost ambushed. You find of the betrayal of the Summoner, which is Apocalypse's grandchild. He has been playing both sides, but really, you know, I shouldn't say he's been playing both sides. He's been a sleeper agent.
Right.
For the forces of Krakoa. And they go and they to make this rescue, and basically there's an ambush.
Yep.
And huge, huge moment is where Apocalypse's original four horsemen attack him and stab him straight through the gut and essentially mortally wound him.
Yeah.
And everything immediately falls apart from there. Another massive, massive moment. Summoner just straight cleaves Rockslide in half, which is, you know, up at that point, he is like sturdy, almost looks like the Thing.
Right.
For those of you that are not familiar with that particular mutant, you know, he's built of rock and he's solid, very sturdy. And Summoner, like without any effort, cuts him in half. So we're immediately out the gate seeing major deaths, major wounds. Of course, Banshee's already there and he is wounded. They've been diseased as well upon taking these hits and getting these cuts. It also infects them. And it's a disease that is clearly hurting mutants. So it's just chaos all around. But at the exact same time, what I'll get into about this issue, there are a lot of really big highlights and a lot of really cool stuff. But for me, it was almost as if, man, I know what's going on because I've been following X-Men for a while. I couldn't imagine trying to read this as a first-time person.
Yeah, it definitely would have been tough to come in and this be your first X book since the Dawn of X. To me, coming in, though, following Excalibur, I was super pumped because I felt like there was a lot of payoff here after the slow build over the course of a year. So I know we had a few side comments when we were first reading it, talking about this and the difference in perspectives. But for me, seeing everything that was leading up, the pieces about Summoner, you know, he was mysterious, kind of playing both sides, but seemed to be an ally. You know, Apocalypse recognized him early in one of the issues from way back when as essentially his grandchild, and, you know, starts dealing with him right away. And so, you know, just to kind of see all that come up and then, boom, this, you know, act of betrayal. And really what I thought was so interesting about this was how much they hurt Apocalypse, you know, right off the bat. So not only did they attack him, but they, you know, almost mortally wound him in a way and make him very vulnerable. And that's not something that we see very often at all with Apocalypse, you know, because he is so powerful. The only time we've seen him really impacted before in the Dawn of X line was when he allowed it to happen in one of the Excalibur issues, where he allowed a super powered up Rogue to essentially kill him, and then he gets the resurrection protocols. But, you know, really puts everything at a head here, because what you start to see with the four horsemen coming back, I mean, they are his children, and we start to see these dynamics of essentially, you know, Apocalypse's family and all these things that have gone on, set him on different paths, starting to get laid out here. And I thought that moment for me was a little different, and I was kind of like pumped about this issue, whereas you weren't feeling it quite as much.
No, I just really wasn't. And I, like we talked about it briefly, but it wasn't hooking me. And that was what I wanted out of this. It's the first issue of a major event, and I want it to come out firing. And while it did have these nice big moments, a lot of it was, call it like higher level type stuff, where it was hints and plot points that were just planted, little seeds all around. And I was like, nothing in this book is quite hooking me for what's to come in X of Swords, you also going into it know that there's 22 issues.
Right.
So, you know, you're like, I want this. This is going to be a long event. This is going to be a big investment in my time. And I want it to be really, really good. Because another thing that we had talked about prior to this was X-Men had been fading.
Right.
For some time, where it came out the gate with House of X, Powers of 10, really great. And the first couple issues of each series was really good. But then as time went on and it got into that secondary and third story arc, it started to fade a little bit. And then, you know, you'd get some highlights here and there. But what I really wanted was a total return to form. And while I got some of it, I didn't get all of it. And that ultimately, you know, let me down. I still think the next few issues, you know, what happens will hype me back up. But out the gate, I was like, I just wanted something maybe a little bigger.
Yeah, one thing I felt with Creation was, you know, we talked about the Prelude issues that they did with Excalibur, and I think there was one for one of the X-Men issues that, you know, were marked as Prelude to this event. But in reality, Creation number one was the Prelude.
Yeah.
And I think that was probably one of the issues with the expectations, was you kind of expected it to just be, boom, we're kicked off here. And in the second half of the book, because it was a thicker issue, it was almost like a double issue book. So the second half started to go down that line, whereas the first half didn't. To give it some credit, I did think that there was some cool kind of premonition parts there. You know, when the beginning we see Opal Saturnine and the tarot cards and some of these different premonitions of what's to come or what might happen, kind of get your mind going. So there was some stuff there, and it had some great art. I thought that the art in this book was pretty cool. But as far as, you know, that meat and potatoes, like, okay, I'm ready for this next event, I'm ready to sink my teeth in, it did kind of temper that back down just from the way that it laid it out. The other thing I will say, though, that I did like a lot here was that we did see some of the power of Opal Saturnine. And, you know, they've showed us her a little bit throughout the Excalibur book, and it's very clear that she is a unique person in the entire, you know, world, or all the realms that are out there. You know, she's kind of the guardian of the Citadel, which is where all of the different worlds connect, but we haven't seen her full might and her full capabilities. So, you know, after the events of the ambush on the X-Men and Apocalypse, you know, we see her kind of come in, she flexes her muscles, you know, everybody's fighting on her land essentially, and she's not having it, and she freezes everybody in place, you know, and slows everything down, and essentially kind of chooses one person from each side to communicate with and establish really what is going to be the Ten of Swords event.
Right. So, and she does, I think she shrinks death.
Yeah.
Which is pretty cool. Like, she cuts him down to size. So it does, it kicks off what eventually is going to be the Ten of Swords event, which is essentially a Mortal Kombat-style tournament.
Yes.
Which says, you know, okay, if these dark forces want to invade Krakoa and they want to invade Earth through the portal of Otherworld, then okay, but we're not going to just let you do it. We're going to make it so it is fair and both sides have an equal opportunity to compete, because the dark army that the Four Horsemen are bringing is unstoppable.
Right.
They're, you know, they've torn through the land of Otherworld and on Krakoa themselves. So understanding that, Opal Saturnine puts these kind of procedures in place, these rules in place, and it really does. And essentially the best way to describe it is a Mortal Kombat style tournament.
Yeah, it was kind of funny when you start to read through those last couple pages and you're like, wait, I know this format before, and you start to realize, like, this is Mortal Kombat, you know, you're like, holy crap, like, it's kind of cool, you know, I'm here for this, to see my favorite X-Men in essentially a fight for the, you know, the fate of the world, a fight for their lives. One thing I think that, just to help illustrate, you know, really the threat, and one reason why this is actually, this tournament, I think, is beneficial for the X-Men, is because the threat that's coming, what was in my mind seeing the Dark Army come through compared to essentially, you know, the couple thousand of mutants that are on Krakoa was the dynamics of the movie 300. You know, you essentially have this unstoppable Persian army that's the greatest that's ever been seen, with warriors and weirdos and everything, you know, beyond what anybody is familiar with. And, you know, warriors for as far as you can see. And then you've got Sparta with, you know, their 300 best champions. That is all that can stand in front of it. You know, if you put those up one-on-one, just like on an open field, there's no hope. You know, I don't think necessarily the X-Men would have much hope here, even if they sent everybody at the Dark Army from a sheer numbers perspective.
Right, yeah.
But when Leonidas is able to bottleneck that army down into where only so many can come at him at a time, it evens that fight up, even if the numbers are so disparate. So I think that that was kind of an interesting, that was what was going through my mind at first seeing it. You know, this is an unfair fight. And then Saturnine comes in and essentially evens the playing field and allows them to, you know, rally their champions. And it's, you know, the best versus the best, essentially.
Yeah, absolutely. And so she does, she allows this to happen, but it also feels like she's manipulating a few things in her own right. So we'll jump over into part two. Before we get there, we should shout out the writers and artists on Ten of Swords creation, because Chris did mention there was a lot of really big splash pages that were really well done. So, you know, writers of this particular issue are Jonathan Hickman and Teenie Howard. They have been writing the X-Men lead series and New Mutants from Hickman. And then Teenie Howard has been the main on Excalibur for a while.
Right.
So, and then you have Pepe Larraz, who's been doing X-Men artist, you know, artistry for a while now, which was pretty cool.
Yeah.
But that does move us on into part two, which is X-Factor number four. So that's kind of the way this works. Like we said, every single Marvel X-Men book that's being published right now is involved. So part two of Ten of Swords is indeed X-Factor number four. Leah Williams and Carlos Gomez are handling the writing and artist respectively here. And this is kind of the events that follow up creation, like immediately. And that's one thing about Ten of Swords. One book immediately follows the other. There's no time gap. There's no jump. It is basically boom, boom at the end of this. And then the next issue immediately picks up where it leaves off. So we see the results of this failed away mission, of this ambush. And essentially, it's the team rushing to get their injured mutants back to Krakoa to safely heal them. So we're looking at Banshee is like critically wounded. Apocalypse is critically wounded. Rockslide is completely gone. And they get them back to Krakoa to start the healing process. And this is where we see one of the biggest twists of this event, in that dying on Otherworld or dying in Otherworld completely disrupts the resurrection protocol.
Yeah, it's one of the biggest revelations for the mutants since they came to be on the island of Krakoa and, you know, had this new way of using Cerebro and the hatchery to cheat death, essentially. You know, for the last year or so, we've been watching them kind of walk around with an air of arrogance of, you know, it doesn't matter what we do, it doesn't matter where we send you, if anything happens, Xavier's going to cook you up a new version of you and you're going to be good to go. And so, you know, they're essentially reacting with their trauma team here to the ambush and brings them back, and they're kind of going into their normal treatment and, okay, let's just get Rockslide going, no big deal, we'll bring him back. And we see pretty much everything for Cerebro completely short out.
Yeah, like across the board, not just the Cerebro that Charles Xavier wears, that helmet, if you've been seeing the art and all of this, he wears this helmet, which is essentially a portable Cerebro. All of his backups, they all short circuit across the board, and there's this hiccup. And then, of course, when Banshee comes back, because Banshee does inevitably die on the table, they're unsure if, like, everything went well.
Right.
Did, you know, were we able to imprint all of your memories onto your body? And what we ultimately find out is for Rockslide is no, it did not go well. It did not work. And he comes back kind of a mutation of every single version possible version of himself throughout the multiverse. That's kind of how I perceived that one. I don't know how you perceive that one.
Yeah, I think they said something along those lines. You know, it's essentially dying in Otherworld voids your identity, your personality. You know, you are never going to be the same again. Even if they can get you back, which is not a guarantee, you're essentially not going to be, you know, you. You're going to have different personalities. You might be violent. You may not have your memories. You know, who knows? I don't think we even know at this point the true extent of what could happen here. But, you know, that was a really big moment for them of realizing, okay, well, we didn't think about this, and we didn't think about there could be something out there where we can't use our resurrection protocols. So it really immediately upped the stakes. You know, this issue of X-Factor, in a way, was kind of slow from the standpoint of what happens. You know, it's mostly just kind of a look into the hatchery and the medical tent, you know, where they're working on Apocalypse. And I have to give a shout out. I thought that seeing Apocalypse again in like a weakened state where he's getting hit by the plague from the horsemen, and, you know, he really looks like he's going to die on the table. Like, they're all kind of really concerned. I thought that was an interesting spot just because, you know, once again, we don't see him that weak very often. But there was a lot of direness to their situation, you know, immediately once you hit this issue.
Yeah, and absolutely. And one thing that really becomes present, and it's been present in X-Factor all along, was that while they have basic resurrection protocols, they're not very detailed.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been the theme of X-Factor the entire time, is that they created a team that could investigate the deaths of mutants to confirm death before resurrection can start. But in this case, in the middle of a battle, in the middle of a war, what is the resurrection protocol? And so they immediately enacted these new addendums. And essentially, and you get info pages, just like all the other X books that have been out there. There are these info pages, and you see the addendums that they put to the resurrection protocol saying, if you die in battle, you basically jump the line
right. And
immediately get resurrected. And that's what we saw with Rockslide, is they immediately, because he died in Otherworld, in creation, that he needed to be immediately resurrected, and it didn't go well. He came back as the amalgam of everything else. And that is the dynamic that I think X-Factor highlights the best, is that it highlights the Five and what they are doing and how they factor into the larger mutant role.
Sure. Yeah, I think we should got to put it together here now. If you think about how the stakes are coming together for this event, you know, we just mentioned in Creation Number 1, we've got a Mortal Kombat-style tournament. And now, in Issue 2, we are hit with the revelation that if you die in Otherworld, where this Mortal Kombat tournament is going to happen and is expected to be a battle to the death, then you do not come back.
Right.
And so it just kicks the stakes up, you know, stakes up completely. And so I thought that this was a moment for me where it was like, okay, now here we go. Now let's jump into this and see what they're going to bring to us in this event.
And you also, at the time, you think, okay, well, Krakoa is just going to throw their 10 best warriors into this fight. But that's not the case. And we see that in this X-Factor issue as well. Opal Saturnine basically sends a message, a mental message to a person on either side of this battle and tells them, you know, rules and prophecies on who is going to participate. And you find out that the tournament is going to take place in Otherworlds and the various kingdoms of Otherworld. So with this prophecy, it's sent to Polaris, Magneto's daughter,
Yep. Which
I think is a very interesting twist. So she blurts out these prophecies, and we see 9 prophecies, which say these are the 9 mutants, and these are the swords that they need to go get, because another piece of this Ten of Swords event, they're duels. They can't just go fight with their mutant abilities. Now, I'm sure they will use them. It's expected to be a sword fight.
Right, yeah. Definitely kind of classic.
Yeah. So we see some pretty cool little prophecies, and just in Hickman style and X-Men style, like, none of it is straightforward. All of it is a mystery.
Yeah.
You know, like, everything's a puzzle. So what we see here is, I don't want to read all of these, you know, different prophecies, but essentially what we get, because at the back end of this issue, we get a breakdown of the various prophecies and who we think the sword bearers are going to be. So short of reading each individual prophecy out, I am going to tell you basically who gets picked.
Gotcha.
And it's Magic, Wolverine, Storm, Cypher. But Cypher's a little different because technically Warlock is picked, but there's a lot going on with Warlock and Cypher right now as they're kind of acting as one.
Right.
Cable, who is in his teenage version, which he doesn't like being called. I'm not young Cable, I'm just Cable. We also get Captain Britain, which of course is Betsy Braddock right now. Captain Avalon, which is of course Brian Braddock, the former Captain Britain.
Yep.
Apocalypse himself, and then Gorgon.
Yeah, definitely a hell of a cast.
Right? Yeah. And some of them are like, you know, you would expect Wolverine. You're like, okay, the healing factor. He's so powerful in his mutant ability, and he's definitely a fighter. He's expected to go there. But a few other like random ones. I thought Cypher was kind of random. Storm caught me by surprise.
Right.
Like a few of those, I was like, wow, okay, the stakes are high here. Like, I thought we would just send, you know, you would have to volunteer.
Right.
But it's not really volunteer. You're being told.
Yeah, you kind of expect Wolverine, Cyclops, you know, those big guys. Gorgon, I mean, he's kind of obvious because he's a fighter. But they don't have a choice. And some of the people, like Cypher, for example, and maybe we'll get into it a little bit later. But just as an example, you know, he's not really a fighter, but he's crucial to the Kurkroan, you know, society, because he's the one person that can communicate with the island of Krakoa and be that translator. So, you know, if he goes, then they've got some other problems of their own from that standpoint. So all in all, it really set the table a little bit better than what Creation did, I thought, because now you're starting to see these characters that you like, you love, you're seeing that they're going to be put on the line. Things are starting to fall into place. I think the last thing I would say here about issue two, just as a shout out, because Rockslide, you know, he kind of felt like an odd choice. He was a fairly new character, I think, you know, in the last little while, and he's very easily forgettable. Like you said, he's kind of like the Thing, but just a pile of rocks put together.
Yeah.
And so it's like, okay, you know, what is it about this guy? But what I thought was kind of cool, how at the end of issue two here, was that whether he comes back or not, whether Rockslide is a very memorable character in the future or not, the way Polaris took his rocks and then used them to make the shrine,
yeah,
where all of the combatants have to meet in order to then go to the tournament, I thought that was kind of a cool way to take this seemingly, you know, throwaway character and kind of cement him into the X-Men legacy in a way for all time, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. And I kind of had forgotten about that particular detail of this issue that she does. She feels so guilty for going on this away mission with Rockslide and him dying on this mission. She feels responsible.
Right.
And so she honors him in a way by creating these symbols and, you know, this circle sphere that essentially when these various combatants are ready to go to Otherworld to start the tournament, you know, they need to go off, they need to get their sword and come back and place it on these symbols in this circle. And then they will travel to Otherworld to start the tournament. And to build that circle out of Rockslide is a very cool touch.
Yeah, little point, easily overlookable, but for some reason that just kind of stood out to me when I was reading through the issue and just kind of gave him more purpose.
Yeah, and I'm sure there are some New Mutant fans out there that are like, Rockslide's amazing, like, what are you talking about? But it's like, yeah, you know, he is a minor mutant in the full history of the X-Men,
right.
I think, in our opinion here. So another piece to the prophecy is, of course, is you get the sword bearers, but it also predicts what sword they're going to be using. So, you know, they have to go, and essentially the next few issues we're going to go through here are various characters going on their missions to retrieve the sword that they are then going to use in the tournament itself. But one of those sword bearers, Magic, already has a sword.
Yep.
And I thought this was a really cool moment for Illyana to just take her soul sword and immediately step up and place it in the circle. And it's like, I know I'm going, and I know I'm going to compete.
Yeah, and she's all about it. She's just like, let's do this. I'm ready. You know, it wasn't even a question. I thought that was a great way to really finish out the book of like, boom, you know, we've got the shrine. Here's our first combatant. Get everybody else together. Let's go.
Yeah, and it really is the very last panel of that issue. And she, quote, as she throws down her sword, says, pound the war drums.
Yeah.
Like, let's do this. Let's go. And Magic is just one of those characters where I think not everybody's going to know who she is and is familiar with her. But, you know, once you start to get her backstory a little bit, you're like, okay, she's pretty sweet because she is Colossus's sister.
Yep.
You know, she's got the soul sword. There's a lot going on there.
Yeah.
Well, we'll jump right into part three. And that takes us to Wolverine number 6. Wolverine, of course, is written by Benjamin Percy. And the art is done by, I'm going to butcher the name and I apologize, Victor Bogdanovic.
Bogdanovich.
Victor Bron. Yeah. So one way or another. Yeah. This one, we first see Wolverine go and get the sword that he is taking into battle. It's a sword that he knows very well, as it's a sword that is ingrained into his history. It's the Muramasa blade, which I thought was an interesting twist with this story and this blade, that's not necessarily a single sword.
Right.
It's a sword made by a person.
And we see as it goes through how that becomes even more into play.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. So basically, he's got to go find this legendary sword maker, finds out in his history through Silver Samurai, which he has a brief duel with. Shout out to that brief duel, because Silver Samurai is essentially pissed that there is a sword duel tournament and he was not selected.
Right.
Considering
yeah.
that's his thing.
I thought that was kind of funny.
So Wolverine beats it out of him that the way to get this sword, the way to find this person, is to go to hell. And honestly, this issue kicks off, like, this is the first issue I was like, yes, like, finally, all right, like, let's go. You know, a lot, everything was, if we say Creation was a prelude, and then X-Factor was a true number one, this Wolverine issue is what made me be like, all right, I'm fucking in, because he goes to hell to retrieve this blade, and it essentially ends up finding the hand.
Yeah.
And fighting the hand, and, you know, running through ninja after ninja, who are basically zombies underneath because the beast has infected them. So there is so much going on in this issue.
Oh yeah.
As that just like, just yes, like it is a premier Wolverine issue.
Well, and leave it up to Wolverine to really take everything to the next level. I mean, we kind of skipped over here, but like, this book actually opened up with Wolverine calling Krakoa out on his shit.
Yeah.
Essentially, because now that they know what's going on here in this essential war that is coming, you know, he's calling out the island of Krakoa because Krakoa wants this gate open. Krakoa's got some selfish or unknown, you know, reasonings that he wanted to keep this gate to Otherworld open when the council was talking about destroying it when they found out about all this stuff. And so Wolverine pretty much starts off his quest by going and telling Krakoa, like, this is on you, bro.
Yeah.
Like, you clearly knew that this was coming. You wanted this. And so whatever happens after this is on you. And then he leaves and he sets out on his journey. But I think what we start to see here with the piece with the hand and their allegiance with essentially, I guess, you know, the devil and hell, is that some things are starting to change in the world. You know, this event that is going on in Otherworld and around the other realities is having some ripple effects on the forces inside Earth. And we see some of that as it moves through, because it introduces the character of Solemn.
Oh, yeah. And Solemn, and I think maybe Solemn is why I got so hyped on this particular issue, because up until this point, you know, granted, it's only 4 issues in the history of X-Men. We're really only getting to see one side.
Yeah.
We're not getting to see the combatants that are coming from Akroa and the other side. But we are finally introduced to one of them, and that is the character of Solemn. And essentially, Solemn, I'd like to look at him as almost the Wolverine equivalent.
Yeah.
On the other side, he's got skin that is made of adamantium. Like, it's basically, you know, microfibered weaved into his skin. But he's also not exactly a good guy on the other side, because we see that he's been in prison for 100 years,
right,
in this land that essentially the children of Apocalypse, who have been ruling the land, had a fight with him, and it was appeared to be a lover's quarrel,
right,
based
right.
on the info pages that we were given, and imprisoned him. But the people of Akroa love him,
yeah.
And so, despite being in prison for 100 years, he's been brought gifts and adored, and it also seems like people are coming to make love with him,
right?
Like, so while he's in prison, it really hasn't been that bad. But it also opens the door a little bit that these forces on the other side are also picking people that they don't feel so great about.
I really like the character of Solemn. I mean, I would absolutely follow an entire book if they just made a book about this character and explained his whole backstory and what he's all about. But, you know, the writing was funny. The way he spurns war and them, you know, when he's getting out, and they all think that they've had him conquered for all this time, and he makes them realize that he's only there because he's chosen to be there. He's kind of like taking a break,
yeah,
you know, just chilling out, and he kind of gets out of the handcuffs and stuff on his own, you know, and just kind of walks out like, hey, okay, you know, I'm here to do this. I really just thought it was all well done. He's a great looking character, you know, the ties in, you know, similarities like you mentioned about Wolverine make him intriguing. So all around, I thought that this was one of my favorite moments of the early issues, but it might have just been one of my favorite moments of the first 11 that we've read so far.
And I would wholeheartedly agree with that, especially the Wolverine issue and then the X-Force issue that immediately follows it. It's kind of one long story.
Yeah.
Like, and it goes, you know, you just follow Wolverine and Solemn. So we'll kind of blend into both here as we deal with Wolverine's issue. And then, of course, X-Force number 13, which is chapter 4, also written by Benjamin Percy, same artist. And I think that's what gives it that vibe that it's just one little, you know, mini Wolverine tale.
Yeah.
So essentially you find that Wolverine does go to hell. He gets attacked by the Hand, thrown into the lava, which is wild, burns away all of his skin, all of his muscles. He's down to his adamantium skeleton. They throw him in prison. And when he wakes up, he finds himself next to Solemn, who has voluntarily come to Earth using his Hellblade into hell, and purposefully gets taken captive so he can get put in jail with Wolverine because he's so eager to meet his other half.
Right, yeah, he's got this awareness of the other half. They're both looking for the same blade, which is really intriguing here because I think that is unique to their path in the fact that they are the only two combatants that are essentially using the same blade in this competition. But I thought that those panels of Wolverine come out of the fires of hell was another highlight moment.
Yeah.
You know, when he's like walking out and it's very Terminator-like, but instead of going into the fire, it's him coming out as a metal skeleton was really freaking awesome. But once again, yeah, in X-Force 13, it just kept on what I was really enjoying about Solomon and Wolverine, and you got more of his humor and his quips and the things he's saying to Wolverine. You know, Wolverine is regenerating at this point, so he can't move or really do much as his body is still like only 50% healed or so based on the art, you know, but you've got Solemn sitting there saying things to him, and you know it's probably just infuriating Logan as he's going, but he can't do anything about it.
Yeah, and he does get so mad, he takes a swipe at Solemn and cuts him across the chest, and that's ultimately how we find out that his skin is adamantium enforced. Essentially, you know, Wolverine is dumbfounded by this, although it's not the first person he's ever come across that is also adamantium infused.
True.
So, and then, you know, you also find out that Solemn has the key to this jail.
Right.
And then they go on a little team up, if you want to call it, like they realizing that they're both after the same sword, but they're also both in the same predicament.
Yeah.
That they're both in jail, but Solemn has the key. So they escape jail and go through hell, only to find out that there's a marriage taking place.
Yeah, this is so weird.
And that was a little bizarre, in a sense that you see the devil or the beast that the Hand, you know, are constantly worshiping and he's basically about to have a marriage ceremony. And it's between his left hand and his right hand, as I believe he says. And the gift to, you know, the bride and the groom is from the sword maker. You know, and he gifts a sword each to these. And that's where you find out that Wolverine and Solemn are going after the same blade, but they might not have to because there's going to be two.
Yeah, and we see it split, so the culmination happens of the marriage and then the Muramasa sword. You know, one of the big things about the lore behind Muramasa and the weapons that he makes is that he, you know, for years and years has figured out how to essentially infuse souls into his weapons, which kind of take them to another level or give them some sort of power over certain things. And so for this, you know, marriage, the two blades that he has to make, Muramasa, I don't know if he was forced or he chose to. I didn't quite get the reasoning there, but he essentially infuses his own soul into both blades and then gives them over to the bride and groom, like you said. But it really doesn't go down as a happy wedding there, because pretty much right after that, we see Wolverine and Solemn come in to claim what they want.
Oh, yeah, and they come in and immediately destroy the bride and the groom. Solemn ends up with both blades.
Yeah.
And they have this little bit of a moment where Solemn's like, I have both blades. I could leave and not give you what you want. And ultimately, they end up working together once again, which is a nice little team up. And you see Solemn's almost respect for Wolverine.
Yeah.
And he sees him as a fighter. And there are some really nice interactions there where he says, you know, ultimately he gives him the sword at a price that we do not know. But he says, I hope to see you on the other side.
I thought that was a really cool way to finish this issue after going through all of this. You know, it's the first kind of quest that we've seen for one of the champions to get the blade. And literally, if Solemn didn't give one of them to Wolverine, like, this whole thing would be over.
Yeah.
And so Solemn could have ended it before it started. And yeah, he pretty much holds him up and he says something like, hey, you know, you want to buy a sword. He had like this little quip that I thought was kind of funny, but it's just like, whatever, you know, what are you going to give me?
Yeah.
And we don't know exactly what that price is, but, you know, that last panel of this issue I thought was really powerful because, you know, Logan comes back to Krakoa. He stamps the blade down in next to Magic. He takes his place, you know, on the shrine, and he questions to himself about whether or not the price would be worth it. So I hope that that will be something that we see in the back half or maybe in the future. You know, what was the price he had to give to Solemn, and will it actually be worth it?
Yeah, and we will see. But we'll move on here to Marauders number 13, which is chapter 5 of the Ten of Swords event. Now, Marauders is typically, it does the writing and the art is a little different from Marauders. They shook it up here. So it's Vita Ayala and Matteo Lali. Matteo has been doing the art on Marauders for a while, so it's really just a new writer. But we follow Storm here. So like I said, each of these follow-up issues are kind of taking your sword bearer and the journey that they have to go on, the quest, as you said, that they have to go on to get these sword. And Storm knows from her prophecy that she needs to go to Wakanda and she needs to get Skybreaker. Skybreaker is an ancient Wakandan weapon. It's essentially the first Wakandan weapon as well.
Yeah, I thought that this was one of my favorite issues front to back of the first 11. You see a lot go on here from kind of the emotional standpoint, the pride standpoint. There's been a fragile relationship for Storm with T'Challa for a long time now. The relationship between Krakoa and Wakanda is kind of fragile as they've, you know, come into place and really come up as a nation. And so even though they're friendly, Storm knows that it's not going to be a comfortable conversation because of those aspects, but also because of what this sword means to the people of Wakanda.
Exactly. And there's a really good dynamic in this issue. I have to agree with you that this issue front to back is really quite a standout because you get so much of Storm's history with Wakanda, her marriage to T'Challa, her relationship with the royal court of Wakanda. And so she goes knowing she's asking a question. She's asking for something that they absolutely cannot give her. And she's going to have to take it. And it's going to sour this relationship that she has built with Wakanda. And because they have been friendly, they have not, they're one of the few countries and one of the few nations that hasn't actually acknowledged Krakoa.
Right.
They didn't accept the pharmaceuticals and the flowers and things like that, like all the other countries did to, you know, acknowledge them as a nation, but they're also not against them.
Right.
But after the events of this particular issue, where we see a lot of the history of T'Challa showing Storm essentially where the Skybreaker is kept,
yeah,
how to get it and how to get by its defenses, which I think is very interesting. And she makes a point to saying it almost as feels he knew I was going to need to do this one day.
Yeah, I thought that was kind of interesting. You know, why would he have gone into such detail when he didn't necessarily have to? But I actually thought that was kind of cool. You know, as somebody that I'm familiar with the Black Panther character in Wakanda, of course, but I've never read any of the Black Panther comics specifically. I've never seen much on, like, all the details of the history of Wakanda. You know, just the fact that it's got rich history, vibraniums from there, you know, those types of things.
Sure.
So I actually thought that this issue was kind of cool from that standpoint, too. Just kind of like a shout-out that it gave us, or it gave me, you know, a little bit more history and backstory on Wakanda, you know, with the Skybreaker sword dating back to literally the original Wakandan king.
Yeah.
And then, you know, being made of like the pure vibranium, you know, some of the first stuff that came out of the mountain, I thought was just kind of a cool touch. And to see, you know, how much it played into the founding of Wakanda and all of that, you know, it really is one of the key artifacts of the people. And that's really one of the reasons why it's so hard for the council or T'Challa to give up, you know, give it up to Storm. And she knows that.
Yeah.
You know, it's not supposed to leave Wakanda.
Well, and it's not supposed to be held by anybody but the King of Wakanda.
That too, yeah.
Which I thought was very interesting because, you know, I'm similar to you. I'm not super detailed on the aspects of Wakandan history. I know of Black Panther. I know the general history. I know of some characters. But I thought it was interesting that if this wasn't already told in a previous Black Panther book, that a essential piece of Wakandan history is being told in an X-Men book.
That's true. That's a good point. Yeah.
And I just thought that that was very bizarre and maybe could play out in the future. Like if they cross this over in some way, that this weapon could come into play for T'Challa.
Sure.
But essentially, Storm goes to get it. She bypasses all of the security measures because she does know how. But ultimately, there is one final gatekeeper, and it is Princess Shuri. She knows that she's coming for it, and she attempts to stop her. They have a fantastic battle back and forth with great pages, great panels, and great art.
Yeah, that was a really cool moment. Definitely a standout moment was seeing the two of them fight. You know, they are essentially sisters-in-law. They're very familiar with each other. At times, they've been very close,
mm-hmm.
you know. But Shuri has her duty. She's got to stand up for Wakanda. And really, ultimately, I think she mentioned a few times that her biggest reason for not giving the sword, besides the fact that T'Challa wasn't there to truly say, yes, you can have it, you know, being king, but she was concerned about the fact that it would cause unrest in the streets. It would essentially cause Wakandans to fight Wakandans and blood to run. And so she's really thinking from the aspect of protecting the Wakandan people, even though, you know, Storm knows that if she doesn't get the sword and go and fight in this tournament, that the Wakanda people are going to suffer, you know, when the Dark Army comes, right? So they're both kind of looking out for the same thing, but just through different perspectives. You know, Shuri doesn't have the full appreciation of what's going on and why Storm is here. But yeah, definitely some great art and some great pages. There was also a moment there where Storm, I think it was a bigger panel, where she powers up the Skybreaker sword with her electricity and then like kills a bunch of Panther bots.
Yeah.
That I just thought was a really good moment in the book. One of my favorites there. And so all in all, she ends up, you know, kind of slowing Shuri down, right, and then gets a little Indiana Jones action, you know. She does the swap.
Yeah. And the Temple of Doom run, yeah. Oh, wow, Raiders of the Lost Ark run.
I thought that was kind of funny with the real Skybreaker and a fake one, you know, to try and minimize the alerts. But all in all, great book beginning to end. And then I don't know if you want to go into it a little bit, but, you know, there's a good moment at the end where she's confronted by Black Panther.
Yeah, so she basically bests Shuri, doesn't kill her, but she bests her, takes the sword, and is, you know, seeing a battle on her way out. And boom, T'Challa finally shows up and confronts her about what she's doing. And, you know, they talk about how I must do this. And T'Challa kind of says, well, you realize by doing this, what you are doing to my people and the people of Wakanda, and also what you're doing to yourself, because you won't be welcome back here if you leave.
Right.
And, you know, and there's tender hearts there because they have been married in the past and they are close. And she essentially says, like you alluded to, I need to do this for the greater good. And despite everyone in Wakanda saying, if these dark forces come through, we will stand next to you. We will stand with Krakoa. But Storm knows the bigger picture and knows that if they come through, no one will last. And it won't matter if we're standing shoulder to shoulder.
Right.
None of us will be able to survive it. So I need to go and represent us and do this on our behalf. And ultimately, and I think this could be huge, T'Challa lets her go.
Yeah, he lets her go, and he knows that he's going to deal with whatever that means on the Wakanda side. But it doesn't come without a price, because as soon as he lets her walk through the gate, he commands that the gate be destroyed. So he's also kind of prepping to, I guess, you know, do some things to take care of the Wakanda side. But it really is another big price. You know, we've already seen here two swords and two big prices paid, with Wolverine essentially dying and coming back, you know, going through the Hellfire to be able to get the Muramasa blade. And now Storm has pretty much like emotionally been wounded and is fractured even more so this relationship between Wakanda and Krakoa. So, you know, it just continued to kind of up the stakes in different ways for not just the individual characters, but also the country of Krakoa as a whole.
You're really looking at, if you survive this battle coming forward, what is life going to be like afterwards?
Exactly.
If you have broken every single alliance you have with the humans.
Yeah.
You know, in the process of doing this, what good is life? You know, but ultimately, as the history of mutants, like, we're doing this to protect you.
Right.
We're trying to work with you, but very rarely does that go the other way and the humans see that they are one of them.
Yeah, there's always a price to be paid.
Absolutely. So then we move on to part six, which is Hellions number 5. And we talked about that price to be paid. Well, the plan is, let's try not to pay that price. Let's try to sneak a team into Otherworld and steal the opponent's blades. And maybe that will be a way that we can prevent this entire thing from happening. So Mr. Sinister, who does kind of lead Hellions a little bit here, says, I've got a team. I've got a plan. Let's go do that. You know, the book opens up with them on the Quiet... Oh, I shouldn't say the book opens up with them on the Quiet Council. The book actually opens up with the resurrection of Empath.
Yeah.
Who's a mutant I'm not too familiar with, but out the gate, he's kind of a dick.
Yeah, me too. I'm not as familiar with him, but yeah, you can tell that he's absolutely a dick. He's always, you know, bumping up against everybody, it seems, and was killed by one of his own team members.
Yeah.
And that's why he's being resurrected. So nobody likes this guy. The ultimate asshole, apparently. Which is kind of funny because his name is Empath.
Right.
You know, so you think like he's going to be somebody like sweet and all that, but he is not. This issue, all in all, was kind of a throwaway. I thought that there was some interesting moments with, you know, the Empath character getting introduced. And Mr. Sinister, you know, he's essentially proposing that they just go steal all the other team's swords.
Yeah.
So that way they can't compete and then they don't have to fight or lose anybody. And, you know, my first question there was like, well, what could go wrong here? You know, you've got Opal Saturnine, who just, you know, kind of seems to know everything and wants her rules to be followed. And, you know, well, let's just go supervent that and try and pull a fast one on her. I don't know if that's going to happen, but
yeah.
But they ultimately agree to it.
Yeah, they ultimately agree to it. Well, the wonder is if they go and they cheat the rules of the fight, that it's going to end poorly.
Because right.
That's if Saturnine finds them that they've been trying to cheat, you know, then all of this is for naught, and they're going to, like, by default lose this tournament. So is it really worth it?
Exactly.
And ultimately they do say yes. It's a bit of Sinister, you know, he makes this, he presents this plan, but he doesn't want to go execute it himself. And the rest of the council's like, well, no, I think you should lead this. And then he tries to flip-flop his vote. And sure enough, Magneto kind of screws him over. And that was my favorite part of this issue. I'd have to agree, there wasn't too much going on, but the few highlights were definitely Sinister related.
Yeah.
Because this version of sassy Sinister, as I call him, is so funny to me. So his interactions with the council and how they all kind of just appear to be exhausted with him.
Yeah, they're over it.
They're just over it. So the council parts were probably the most interesting and the most intriguing because you don't get too many, and very rarely do you get to see them making a decision as a group.
Yeah.
Like, they're always talking about something or discussing something, but and then it'll change, and the scene will change. Here, we actually got to see them, the process of the vote, the different dynamics of the council, because it's a mixed bag of who is on this council.
Right.
And I almost thought it's almost more villain leaning than hero leaning.
In some ways it is. Yeah. And it's like, they're always trying to rein each other in, because they all have kind of their own voice and their own pool, but you know, you have that. And then you have some of it's like appeasement.
Yeah.
You know, like they knew that they needed some of these types of characters on the council, not just the good guys, not just, you know, Xavier's folks. They needed all these different people to try and control everything, since the heroes and the villains are all, you know, welcome on Krakoa. So it always makes for an interesting moment when they do the council moments. But to your point, they are few and far between. So yeah, them kind of screwing Sinister over while he's trying to screw everybody else over was a good twist. And then just to your point, too, I thought that it was funny when Sinister goes down and he's messing with one of the other clones of himself.
Yeah.
And they've got that back and forth. But then you see that their decision-making system is essentially like street rock, paper, scissors.
Yeah.
You know, they just drop down and do some RPS to figure out, you know, who's going to go, who's going to survive, and who's going to be the actual Mr. Sinister.
And I think they call it like the ultimate battle. Or something, to, you know, of all that, like, the noblest of contests.
Yeah.
I think that's what, yeah, he calls it. He's like, the noble contest then? He's like, best two out of three? And he's like, I said the noble contest, didn't I? Which you have to assume is best of one, the way RPS is meant to be played.
Yeah. That cracked me up. It was like, all this, like, high-risk stuff. And, of course, Mr. Sinister would decide it with just some straight-up rock, paper, scissors.
Yeah. But in the end, it's all about his cape.
Yeah, right.
It's all about his kid.
That's all they wanted.
That's all it is. So while the overall plot didn't advance much here, you know, there were some, you know, moments that make you smile, moments that make you happy. So shout out to writer Zeb Wells, artist, you know, Carmen Canero. I can't say that I'm going to continue reading Hellions after this. It was one of the few X books that I didn't follow leading into this. And I was kind of hoping that I would read it, be intrigued, and to pick up more Hellions issues down the line, but I can't say that that happened.
Yeah, we'll have to see. It didn't do anything for me to be like, oh, let me check out this book. And it really didn't even end on any sort of definitive measure. You know, it was kind of a cliffhanger. We do see them go into Avalon and then Otherworld. You know, they begin this quest, but, you know, very little happens on that side. And then it just kind of drops off and moves into the New Mutants issue.
Yeah, and so we move on to New Mutants number 13, which is part 7 of 10 of Swords. Writer Ed Brisson, artist Rod Race, or Riez, however you'd like to say that there. And this was an interesting issue because it's completely devoted to Cypher.
Right.
And essentially training him to be a fighter, because like we said, he's not a fighter, he's a communicator. You know, he's typically a passive person, but he's decided to enter this tournament with Warlock as his sword, using Warlock's body manipulation, you know, to create the sword, which I thought was a really cool little aspect of this.
For sure.
But he needs to learn how to fight. So this entire issue is devoted to Magic's interactions with him in teaching him how to be a swordsmith, or a sword bearer, excuse me.
Yeah, it was another issue that was on the slower side of things, you know, probably one of my least favorites if I just had to rank them. But it had a couple few moments like that, you know, seeing the Warlock sword, the fact that it can shapeshift and project energy and things like that, you know, I think could come into play, you know, they essentially have a lifelong friendship between Cypher and Warlock. So will we see some emotional moments come in, like during the battle? Everybody's worried about Cypher already because he's not a fighter,
yeah,
including Krakoa. You know, everybody is trying to keep him from even having to go and do this fight. So I thought that that fact about the Warlock sword will probably give us some sort of payoff in the later issues, you know, just because there's a lot on the line there from their personal standpoint. But other than that, I did think it was cool that they showed him, you know, training a little bit and you know, the care that everybody has for Cypher. But really, this was one of the more boring issues. And I don't know if it was even that so much, but like, I did not like the art in this issue at all. You know, it seemed like it was almost like watercolors. Like, it had a very different style than everything else. And I was really digging the covers and the art for every issue, even the ones for the books that I haven't personally been following as much. I was really into everything. And then it got to this one, and I was like, ugh, like, what is going on here?
It is a little different, and watercolor is a good way to put it. I know, I don't think it's actually watercolor, but it's a lot of blended colors all together to give that watercolor feel.
Yeah.
I enjoyed it just as a change of pace.
Okay.
I guess, you know, it's not my favorite, and I don't know if the art alone would be enough to hook me to read New Mutants long term. But just as like a change of pace from the super detailed and the hard lines, you know, more of something that's wishy-washy, you know, in the watercolor style, I appreciate it just for a one-off issue. Like, if every issue was this way, I would struggle.
Right. I think the only other thing I thought was noteworthy out of this issue, besides the Warlock sword, was we did get the info panel on the Soul Sword.
Yeah.
Which is what Magic uses. And, you know, it comes from Limbo. She's had it for a long, long time. It's a magical focused sword, but there's a few things in that info panel that I thought were kind of interesting. You know, it's capable of summoning and teleportation and spell breaking. So there's some really interesting powers there that could come into play when dealing with some of these beings from these other worlds. But the two things that towards the end were that it said that certain users can unlock powers that are embedded into the sword by previous wielders.
Yeah.
And so, you know, maybe we'll see some surprise events or powers come from that Magic taps into with that sword. There was a note that said from Professor X's files that the Soul Sword can be used as armor. And he had been exploring these, like, other applications of the Soul Sword specifically. So I thought that was something that was like, oh man, you could almost completely miss this because it was an info page. But all of those little details seem like something that could really make or break maybe Magic's contest or who she fights when we get to the actual tournament.
No, it definitely could. I know in previous iterations of Magic, she holds the sword in her right hand and then typically she gets like almost the Final Fantasy style one-armed armor that goes up to her shoulder.
Yeah, that's
true. And this particular design of her isn't exactly that. Like, she's wearing kind of like almost a, you know, her stomach is exposed. So, you know, what I would say, like...
Like a midriff?
Like a midriff. Yeah, she's wearing, you know, like midriff armor, you know. But it would be interesting to see her go full on. You know, all the way up and maybe develop full body armor. That would be super cool. More than just a single arm.
Right.
Another piece of the Soul Sword that I thought was interesting, and it plays into a few of these swords, is that their length can vary depending on who's holding it, or it can be adaptable on how they want to use it. And the Soul Sword plays into that. So it's not a set length.
Yeah, there's a lot of factors with some of these weapons that I think, depending on how the fights go and where the creative team wants to take it, could make for some epic fights. Like, it's got me really excited just to see, you know, when we get into these one-on-one sword fights, exactly where they go, what they show off, you know, what happens in the fight that forces them to tap into some of these other abilities of the swords, you know, versus just being, hey, just a sword, right? Like, none of these are just swords. They all are very powerful, magical, mystical weapons, you know, that can go well beyond just cutting things, right? So
yeah,
it should make for some very interesting stuff. I think at this point in the story, we're at four swords have been identified. Is that true?
Four swords? Yeah. Yeah. Because you've got Storm, You got Magic coming out the gate with Soul, the Soul Blade, Storm coming in with Skybreaker, Wolverine with Masamura, and Cypher using Warlock.
Yeah, so we're almost halfway.
Almost halfway. But it takes us to our next sword, which is also very intriguing. And it's Cable, number 5, chapter 8 of 10 of Swords. And here we kind of take a break from the tournament in itself, and we get a little side tale where it's Cyclops, Jean Grey, and Cable, you know, the old Summers family, and they've gone to the recently resurrected, you could call it, sword station in space.
Right.
And it's a bit of an away mission. And I think the one cool thing at the beginning of this is you see Magic getting in touch with Cable, and that he needs to come back and participate in this tournament. And we saw a matching scene at the beginning of New Mutants from the other side. It's basically Magic delivers the news to Cable and then turns around and starts working with Cypher. And in here, we basically were given that this is happening at the same time as Cypher's training
right.
type setup, where we see Cable receiving the message while he's in space, you know, with his mother and father doing something. They're kind of investigating this empty sword station that has appeared because he stuck his sword, the Light of Gladiador, into the station, which has completely powered it up.
Right.
And now they're trying to figure out, why is it empty? Where are the people that run this station? And ultimately you find out that there's an open portal on the station that has let other beings, aliens, I kind of took them as, they almost reminded me of the Borg.
Yeah, very Borg-like. Yeah.
From Star Trek, very Borg-like, coming through. And like, while nothing major happened in this issue for me, I love, love, love when Cyclops fucking goes crazy. And this issue gave me that. We got to see Cyclops just teeing off on some aliens.
Yeah, they eventually open up that portal. They realize that there is something very nefarious here. I think they called it the Viscora.
Yeah.
Or the Faceless Death. It was very plague-like, very Borg-like. And it had wiped out all the humans or the people that were on this space station before. I thought that it was some really creepy moments. Like, she encounters that guy with the black eyes who's trying to explain to her what happened and how everybody died. He's like a vision, essentially. And then, yeah, we get to go and see where Cyclops and Cable open the door, essentially, and let out this race that had been kind of locked behind some security protocols. And Cyclops just goes ham,
yeah,
you know, just blasting all of them away as they try to escape. And I thought that that was a cool moment. I had it as one of my highlights of the series so far, but I felt more like a setup, you know, like some of those issues we saw with the X-Men where they would encounter a new race or something would happen, but they would kind of leave it there. And we were kind of confused as to exactly how it fit into all of the stories that are going on. I kind of had a similar feeling with this issue of, okay, the Viscora are going to come back into play at some point. Maybe not now, but this is still Hickman and them continuing this trend of setting up the future, even though, you know, big events are happening now.
Yeah, planting those seeds for the future. And I kind of had a similar vibe where they discovered this people, this race, and obviously they're just coming through the gate in droves, not able to handle the constant waves. So I kind of thought maybe they're going to use them in the future somehow to combat the endless dark forces that we're getting on the other side.
Ah, okay. That's an interesting thought.
That's what I could potentially see if this whole tournament thing falls apart or something happens, because, you know, we've seen enough Mortal Kombat to know that typically the results of the tournament aren't the final factor and that all hell is going to break loose.
Sure.
So I could see them coming back to this and being like, ah, we planted this seed.
Yeah.
And we'll get to use it.
I thought it was interesting how at first it seemed to almost make things even more dire. Like, okay, now there's another giant army that's going to attack them from like another angle, essentially.
Yeah.
But I did think that it was kind of cool the way it closed out. You know, Cyclops, the ever optimist, you know, he's just always kind of got that leading positive spirit to him. And he ends up kind of closing out the issue a little bit, saying that everything was going to be okay.
Yeah.
Like, regardless of all that's going on, you know, he has that sense that, you know, they're going to be able to make it. So I didn't know if that was another little piece of an omen, just telling the reader, like, okay, it's looking really bad right now, but the X-Men are going to come out on top. Or maybe if that'll play in some other way at a later date, you know, maybe things won't end up being okay. But I just thought that was an interesting moment that they kind of made a point to call out in a panel.
And it was an interesting moment for Cyclops because he's been a minor player in this entire event.
Yeah, true.
You know, being the leading general of the Krakoan armies, and he's been fairly silent this whole time.
Yeah, you would expect him to definitely be one of the champions, and he's not at all. And you actually see some of that, now that you mention it, we saw some of that conflict happened in this issue, because when he realizes that his son, Cable, has to go and be a part of it, he said, I think on maybe two occasions, you know, I'll take your place, or I wish I could take your place.
Yeah.
And we saw that a little bit with Cypher, and I think it was Exodus came and offered to take his place. But, you know, what it all returns to is these people, you know, the X-Men, no matter what their status is, they realize that it has to be them. They have to make this sacrifice, you know, and go and combat it. But maybe a little bit of conflict with some of the other characters who either think they should be there or would prefer that their lives are on the line.
Yeah, it's very interesting dynamic, very interesting. And I'd like to see, you know, moving forward, S.W.O.R.D. is getting its own series.
Oh, okay.
Or has gotten its own series. It's literally, it's called S.W.O.R.D. So we'll see what spawns out of Ten of Swords that with this new space station, you know, that is always in Marvel lore.
Yeah.
You know, as this outward station that's there to detect alien threats. So we'll see how that plays out. You know, I believe that series started up this week at the time of recording.
Okay.
But it's only a number one. And, you know, we'll see how it all plays out. Before we get off of it, I want to talk about Cable's sword. And the one big piece of Cable's sword that I thought was interesting is that it contains power and knowledge.
Right. And they don't know where it's from.
Yeah.
You know, specifically. Like, there's thoughts there, but they're more theories than they are fact. So it was the Sword of Galador, I thought, was really interesting from a few of those standpoints. I don't know much about it at all, but Cable's had it for a long time.
Yeah, he's had it at least since he came back as, you know, a teenager.
Right.
In that whole, which was pre-Dawn of X, really, is when they did that crossover bit or that miniseries bit where he comes back and kills his older self and then kills actually the Young Mutants, and it helps set up our current era of that. So he's had it for a bit. I don't think he brought it with him when he came from the future, but he's had it for a while, at least the time that he's been young.
Right, and being with the knowledge piece, they said that he's actually able to tap into it with his telekinetic powers.
Yeah.
So we don't get a lot of details there, but just another little tidbit of the info page was that it called that out, and so I wonder how exactly he uses that to his advantage.
Yeah.
You know, in the tournament or maybe moving forward.
But moving forward, we will to part 9, Excalibur 13. We finally rolled back around, and this is where I started to get excited. Like, all right, we've gone through each series once, and we're going to start rolling back and going through each one a second time. So we're back to Excalibur. That, of course, is Teeny Howard's main book, and artist R.B. Silva back on it. And this one sees Betsy going to Avalon to get her sword, and of course, her brothers are there with them. And I thought, you are the Excalibur guy. This had to be an awesome issue for you, seeing Betsy go, interact with Jamie, interact with Brian, interact with Opal Saturnine, and kind of play some tricks to get her sword.
Yeah, there's been a lot of conflict between Betsy and Saturnine around the whole Captain Britain aspect because, you know, it's not supposed to be mutants. Saturnine doesn't really like mutants. And she's very fond of Brian Braddock, who's been her Captain Britain for a long, long time. You know, he's, I guess, renowned as like the best Captain Britain there's ever been. So
very fond as well.
Very fond of him, as we see, you know, but it really was kind of a cool another stepping stone for the Excalibur storyline because it brought, I think, a few of those conflicts and tensions that have been building in the previous issues back to a head. And even got a little bit of payoff in some ways because we see, like you mentioned, her going after her sword. You know, there's been a conflict going back to when Brian got released from Morgan Le Fay's powers. You know, she kind of took him and made him into this dark knight, essentially, with the Sword of Might, and he didn't really like that. And so we see them, you know, he's been struggling with the fact that he's not Captain Britain. He doesn't have the Amulet of Right anymore. He was given the Sword of Might, and he's kind of afraid of it. He doesn't really want to wield it. He doesn't want to use it. And so, you know, we see the conflicts between Betsy and Saturnine, but we also see some of the conflicts between Betsy and Brian over these things. And ultimately, they're both needed because, you know,
yeah.
Brian is essentially one of the combatants as Captain Avalon with the Sword of Might. And then Betsy is one of the combatants as Captain Britain with the Starlight Sword.
Right. And that Starlight Sword is kind of the key piece here because they need Opal Saturnine to, you know, pull it from her magical realm. That's kind of how I saw it there, like create it, not necessarily like straight up create it, but she held it.
Right.
And so how could Betsy enter this tournament with this sword that she's destined to have if Opal won't give it to her? So they had to play some fishiness here to get her to create it so Betsy could sneak in and get it. And that was Brian playing into that fondness that Opal has for him, you know, and sneaking into her room for maybe a little bit of sexy time, only to distract her to get the Starlight Sword so Betsy could sneak in and get the Starlight Sword.
Yeah, it's kind of a complete shift of happenings here because, you know, we actually at one point see what looks like Saturnine finally getting her way, you know, and taking the Amulet of Right away from Betsy. Ultimately, Betsy actually just destroys it in front of her, you know, but you think that Saturnine walks away thinking that she's kind of got the upper hand again now. She's going to get rid of Betsy, Captain Britain. She's going to get Brian, Captain Britain back. And she thinks that Brian's kind of at her beck and call. So, you know, the Amulet of Right gets destroyed. Everybody's kind of like, what the hell's going to happen? They retire to their chambers. And we see, yeah, Brian and Opal go back to her bedroom where she makes the sword because it's part of the Citadel. The Starlight Sword is actually made from the Starlight Citadel, so it's kind of imbued with some of that power and magic. So she crafts it, and then she's trying to get that D. You know, she's trying to lay down and get some of Brian. But, you know, ultimately, we end up seeing kind of the switcheroo, and the Braddock family were a little bit in tune with what was going on, and they use it as a distraction so that way Betsy can get her hands on the Starlight Sword so she can take her place for the tournament.
And she does. She ultimately gets the sword. You know, Saturnine is pissed. But it once again, it plays into this idea that Saturnine is manipulating this entire situation.
Right.
You know, she has concocted this tournament, and yet she's moving the chess pieces the way that she sees fit. So is it really a fair tournament? What is going on here? And that's all I kept thinking that this entire thing is, what is Saturnine getting at? Because she's the one that's created this mess, but yet, and she's helpful and not helpful at the exact same time at different aspects with different people. And I think she just has an end game that I keep wondering, is it going to work out for her? Is it not?
Yeah, she's definitely some selfishness to her, but she's also been tasked with so much because she's kind of the one that holds like all the realms together.
Right.
The Starlight Citadel is like the glue between all of the different worlds. It's the central location. And so I see her as one of those characters, you know, the anti-hero or anti-villain. I always get them mixed up as to which is the best way to describe them, but, you know, she has to play both sides in most events because of the fact that she has to let things happen as they happen, but she also has to know when to pull the strings to make sure that these actors in the worlds don't just, like, destroy everything and ruin everything. But she's, from moment one, she's had nefarious intentions going on, and you always know with her that things aren't necessarily what they seem because she's a schemer.
Absolutely. So Brian and Betsy come back to Krakoa. They put their blades down, and we are officially sitting at 7 blades. So we are almost there with all the blades of Krakoa represented, and it brings us to the final two parts of X of Swords Part 1 here in our breakdown, and that is X-Men Issue 13, Chapter 10. And this one, we really go back to Apocalypse.
Yep.
And kind of get a little more history out of Apocalypse. And these have been, like, my favorite issues because, like I said, we get so much of Krakoa, and we're already so familiar with a lot of these characters. When we get little touches of the other side, I'm, like, all in and I'm, like, drooling over it. So we really see Apocalypse and kind of his backstory and his relationship with the forces of Krakoa, being his children, his grandchildren, and ultimately his wife, in which we thought was deceased.
Yeah, I geeked out hard on this one. This was maybe my favorite moment of the first 11 issues. I am all in, just like I was with Solemn, and I said that I would follow a story based just around Solemn. I am really intrigued and all in on this character, Genesis.
Yeah.
And, you know, we get that backstory. We see how they stood together. You know, she was his wife. They, you know, the children of the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse. And how all of that came to be when the original land was cracked, you know, and they were fractured here. But she seemed to be really intriguing because of the fact that from Apocalypse's own mind or her own words, you know, she seems to be the stronger being.
Yeah.
She seems to be the more powerful rock of the relationship, and even describes Apocalypse as being weak at times, you know, when he's doing these flashbacks, and you think, how could Apocalypse be considered weak? You know, he's been one of the most powerful beings that we've ever known, and now you have this other character. So I really like the backstory. It kind of just feeds into the Excalibur storyline and really starting to put some of the pieces together. Kind of took Apocalypse to a new level, too. I thought that it made him more intriguing. It took him a layer deeper with his family and seeing these beliefs and, okay, like, some of the things he's been doing is because of this.
Yeah.
And that's a very, like, virtuous reason, if you think about it. Like, he's doing these things for his family, even though maybe some of the other X-Men are, you know, see it as nefarious or selfish.
Yeah. And one thing that I remember from the earlier issues of X-Men, when Dawn of X first kicked off, was that they said if Apocalypse could ever get his original Four Horsemen back, he would do it at all costs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he said multiple Four Horsemen over the years, but it's the original four that he misses and would do anything to get them back. And yet here we are in a situation where they have returned, but they're seemingly on the opposite side of him.
Right.
But what would he do? What could he do to maybe turn them, to return them to his side and reunite everyone? And it perfectly plays this dynamic where he still clearly has love for his wife. He still has love for Genesis. He still has love for his children.
Right.
Even though they're at odds right now.
Yeah. It was definitely a notch mover for me. You know, I thought that this really took it. Okay, here we're about the halfway point of the event, and I thought, like, that was one of the moments I had been waiting for a long time, was to, like, really get this reveal of who some of those characters are, why some of these things are going on. And so I liked her design, I liked her look, I liked the backstory, I want more of it. You know, I was really, really into Genesis when they showed this.
Yeah.
I think that it kind of overshadowed some of the other stuff we saw in this issue. But I do want to give a shout out to the swords that we got mentioned here, because we didn't see a whole lot.
No.
You know, like in some of the other issues, we saw this, like, long quest of the characters going after these swords. When it comes to Godkiller and Grasscutter, that, you know, Gorgon, I guess, is supposed to be wielding, they don't really give us much from a Gorgon standpoint. They pretty much just gave us this info page. And the reason why I want to call it out was because they say that these swords were made at the request of Zeus and Amatsu Mikaboshi, which are essentially, you know, Zeus, of course, is a Greek god. And then Amatsu, it said, is a Japanese god. And they were formed when the two were, like, at war.
Yeah.
You know, back in the olden times. And it was forged by, you know, a smith in the Forge of the Gods. and it said that one blade is perfect and one blade is flawed.
Right.
And so I just thought that it was really interesting stuff that came with these two, even though we got like less about them than almost any of the other swords.
When it shined a light on Gorgon and himself, because we don't get a lot of information about Gorgon.
True.
And so what is he going to do with these blades in this tournament? And I'm almost a little fearful that it's going to go to this like cliche trope where he's like a badass, and he's clearly a badass because we saw him way back in X-Men number 4 be a badass with these two blades.
Right, right.
And what I don't want to happen is to him to enter this tournament full of confidence to get destroyed in 2 seconds. if that happens, I'm going to be so sad. Because he is so badass and he's so confident. He's got these two blades. He's got a great look.
Yeah.
And then if he enters this tournament and gets annihilated in like 5 seconds, I'm going to be like crying.
That would be tough because he seems so cool. But now that you say that and the way they've set it up, like just thinking normal storytelling and all of that, you know, tropes. He might be a sacrificial lamb.
Yeah.
You know,
It could be. But we will see. We will see another interesting point about his two blades, because as cool as he is, the blades kind of take the peak here. Is the history is God made them, man spoiled them, but one mutant raised them.
Yeah.
And so it's like, all right, but is that Gorgon? Like, is he the one making them famous right now? Time will tell. We'll have to see. But he did ultimately go on a quest to Egypt with Apocalypse in this issue to get Apocalypse's blade back, which is Scarab,
right,
which he had buried long ago to never use, but now he needs it again, so they go on this quest to retain it.
Yeah, and the Scarab sword had some immediate interesting aspects to it in history. They said that it was forged by Genesis's sister, Iska the Unbeaten, and it was, you know, forged back in the time of Akara. And so, you know, it's clearly a long-historied sword that has a ton of power. They said it's imbued with eternal sadness.
Yeah.
So I don't know what that means or how that comes into a fight, but, you know, it seemed like an interesting fact. But ultimately, Apocalypse had broken it.
Yeah.
You know, he wielded it back in the olden times, and then when he lost the Horsemen and he lost Genesis, you know, he broke the sword apart, I guess, as part of his struggle or his sadness. And so we see at this part when he goes to get it at the end of this issue that he buried the four pieces in the four tombs of the four horsemen.
Yeah.
All those fours. And so he goes and he's retrieving them from like the caskets in an Egyptian pyramid. So I thought that was kind of an interesting way to tie the horsemen to the, you know, real world of Earth. Because their sarcophaguses were there.
Were still there, yeah. And it does show that they were there at one point.
Right.
And then before we move off X-Men and get into the part 11, which is Stasis, we should talk about Annihilation, the power of Annihilation, the golden helm of Ammeth.
Yes.
Which is the helm that Genesis is wearing. So part of the lore of all of this is, like I said, the Twilight Sword cleaved Akara in half and broke it into Akara and Krakoa, and war was taking place. They did that, you know, the four horsemen of the apocalypse and Genesis stayed on the Akara side.
Yep.
To fend off this dark army. And then ultimately throughout the history of that kind of area and what happened is Genesis went to Annihilation to end the war, to end the army. But it doesn't come without sacrifice, as we've seen in all of Ten of Swords, as she defeats Annihilation, only to realize that she now needs to take its place.
Right.
And put the helm on. And the helm is very much like the Dr. Fate, like the helm of fate on the DC side of things, where you put it on and you become that entity. And that entity almost controls you.
Yeah, it said that it kind of reminded me of like a Pandora's box type item, but in a crown. But it said it's a possessed helm that allows the wearer to rule the dark world of Ammeth, but it also rules the wearer.
Yeah, yeah. And that's why I very much compared that to Dr. Fate and kind of the helm of fate, because it's very similar. But we also see that she freely takes it on and off.
Right, right.
Like, which is not like the helm of fate, I'll say, on the DC side. Once you put that on, like fate has to have you take that off. Genesis seems to be able to take it off whenever she'd like, but she always puts it back on to battle.
And I thought it was pretty cool, you know, to see her return in that way. You know, that was a pretty big reveal, and seeing her kind of standing on the other side after all this time, you know, especially with even more power, it seems, from when we saw her the first time. And that crown of Amenth, I thought, had a great look to
it. Oh, yeah.
Like, it's imposing, even though it's like a single item. It completely kind of changes the dynamic of the character look. It's got, you know, the different kind of like goat horns coming off, like 4 or 6 of them,
yeah,
over a creepy, you know, golden mask. So you can tell that it's definitely one of those items that could be kept around in lore for a long, long time as one of the, you know, top powerful items in the Marvel universe. But I thought that the last thing to share that was pretty interesting was that it kind of hinted or said that it's potentially possessed by a very old god.
Yeah.
Or maybe even a, like, evil spirit that's been born of Amenth itself, because Amenth is essentially like a hell. It's a very dark,
yeah,
evil world where a lot of the bad guys go, you know, or are sent, like, the worst things in all the universes are kind of contained there once they're defeated. And so they didn't know really exactly what drives the Crown of Amenth, but I thought the idea of it being essentially like an evil spirit born of all of the evil that's on this planet would be a really cool idea.
No, it would be. It would be like kind of just a nice little twist, a little more like just something different to the story that could factor in, like, all the other small pieces and plants that have been, you know, placed all along. Also very interesting is nobody knew, you know, the story is Genesis went to fight Annihilation and never came back.
Right.
So that was a great reveal when she took the helm off and that exposed that she was still alive. Thought that was really cool.
Yeah, for sure.
But that does bring us to part 11, which will close out our part one of this discussion. And that is the Ten of Swords stasis event. This one was really cool to me because all along, like I said, we've been seeing the sword bearers on the Krakoan side, and now we finally get to see how the sword bearers on the Ukroan side came to be. And it was just, I think it was another enlarged issue. It ran through the history of each sword bearer, the prophecies that they had, and ultimately it pieced together the 10, which I thought was interesting that there's definitely 10 on one side and 9 on the other.
Yeah, I picked up on that too, and I actually went back at one point and was like, did I miss one
on
the Krakoa side? But it seems like there's something more to be shared, you know, even though it seems like everybody's come together.
Yeah, and so we met the various sword bearers and kind of a blitz through it all. We already knew Solemn and that he was wielding the Muramasa blade. Then we see the White Sword, which is wielding Purity. And the White Sword is essentially this person that lives on the other side and can resurrect an army of 100. Then, of course, we have the Children of Apocalypse, War and Death, each wielding their own blades. Then we already talked about Iskka, the Unbeaten, Genesis's sister, which is very intriguing. Red Root, the Forest. Summoner, of course, Apocalypse's grandchild. Bay, the Blood Moon. Annihilation themselves, and then Pog or Pog, which looked like a gigantic dinosaur.
Yeah, he was like a T-Rex fused with Goro.
Yeah.
Like, he had, like, multiple arms, but he was, like, a giant T-Rex, and, like, his name was Pog or Pog, and his sword is Pog or Pog.
Yeah, it was interesting, kind of odd twist. I hope it's the Gorgon version. I hope it's the sacrificial lamb that looks badass but isn't.
It was kind of cool, but it was one of those issues very similar to Creation, even though I thought it was a better issue than Creation, but there was, like, both a lot that was introduced and, like, a little that happened.
Yeah.
And so it was very cool to finally get over on the opposite side and see how they were coming to the swords. But one thing I noted was that because they blitzed through, you know, 9 of them, since we already had seen Solemn, you know, we only got very little chunks of story,
yeah,
you know, so at most it was like a page or two. Sometimes it was a couple panels. And so I kind of got this sense that even though some of these characters were kind of cool and there was some lore going on, it made me feel like immediately the sacrifices that the X-Men were making in order to get their swords were much greater than what the champions of the Dark Army essentially were having to do to get theirs.
Yeah.
And it wasn't that there wasn't some conflicts, you know, like clearly the horseman and the white sword are not friends.
Yeah.
And, you know, so there was some moments there where he's kind of making them beg for his participation, you know. But all in all, it was just less conflict. It was a little less interesting, even though the blades themselves or the characters might be interesting. You know, Bay the Blood Moon, I thought was a awesome looking character who, very similar to Magic, was just like, yep, let's do this. I'm here to fight.
Yeah, I'm in.
But we got nothing about her. And it was very similar. Like, I thought the White Sword himself was a very interesting character. He looked like Thanos.
Yeah.
But, like, in, you know, white, amazing armor, very clean looking. And he has, like, almost like a Buster Sword kind of look to it, you know? And
yeah.
And maybe we'll get more as we get into the back half of the event. But that's really what it kind of left me as, was like, oh, man, like, here's all these little tidbits of these characters. But nothing was really, like, enough meat to sink your teeth into.
No, I would agree with that. I would agree that they were based on cool look, cool sword, and all of them were like, yep, let's do this. And I'm hoping that they flush that out on the back end, you know, as we get into the tournament that you would imagine is going to happen. Because at the end of this, they do. They all come together. They teleport to the Citadel, where Saturnine is prepared to host a dinner. And start, you know, the festivities of the tournament, you know, and that sort of thing. So we hope that they flesh out those characters, maybe see some betrayals, because, as you said, not everything was great with the White Sword. Obviously, not everything is great with Solemn. So we could be seeing some betrayal here. That would be very cool and kind of different.
Right.
You know, we're just looking for twists. And that's kind of what my vibe is on all of the first 11 issues of Ten of Swords, is that each individual moment was cool, but, like, as a whole, like, it just wasn't really doing anything for me yet. Like, the single quests had their highlights, art looked good, I still like the premise, but I'm, like, waiting for these, like, true massive moments.
Yeah.
And I'm really hoping that the back half picks it up and really helps with that.
Yeah, I agree. You're looking for that blow me away the way that House and Powers did,
yeah.
You know, where there was just multiple revelations and timelines and just everything about it. You know, they set the bar so high that when we came into this, we're expecting, you know, how do you outshine that? How do you pick it up from the slower pace that the issues got on the back half of Dawn of X and things like that? So I'm with you there. I felt like I was enjoying it maybe a little bit more, but it goes back to, like we said, with that Excalibur tie-in and just how much I felt like it was starting to pay off on some of those other things. But for the most part, I had similar sentiments of it was good, not great, and we're looking for great on the back half. I do have to point out, though, that I thought that Stasis had my favorite panel or page, I guess, out of all of the art of all the books. And that was the one where it showed the champions from both sides mirrored together with, like, the two shrines and all of them holding their swords of, you know, and how they were all kind of different versions of each other. Like, I was sitting there kind of looking at it and, you know, the similarities and the differences between some of these people. I mean, we've got, for example, Cypher, you know, being the translator for Krakoa. Well, one of the
Red Root
on the other side is essentially the voice of Araco, and is pretty much a very Cypher like character, even though maybe she's more of a warrior. I don't know. You know, we'll have to see exactly how it shakes out. But there's some very interesting similarities and differences between who each of the champions are for their armies.
And it'll be interesting to see how they play out moving forward in the tournament itself. Is it going to be a one-for-one matchup? You know, on paper, we would expect Solemn and Wolverine to face each other, but maybe not. You know, and how's that dynamic going to work if Wolverine expects to see him on the other end and then doesn't, and he gets Bay of the Blood Moon?
Yep.
And how does that work? And you know, knowing that this guy has this unbeatable sword, and I would like to use my unbeatable sword against him, but the tournament doesn't quite allow it. So yeah, it'll see if they match up one for one or if it's a mixed bag.
Yeah, I had that same thought, actually, was are we going to get these very like obvious matchups, you know, Red Root versus Cypher, or like you said, Solomon Wolverine, or is it going to be completely mixed up and we've got very different characters now fighting each other?
Yeah.
You know, or like, do we see Cypher go up against Genesis?
Yeah.
You know, or something just like ridiculous, you know?
Poor Cypher.
And the other thought I had was, is it going to actually be like a tournament? Like, is it going to be a you know, 26-5-1, you know, whatever, however that breaks down? Or is it going to be essentially just one versus one and we're looking for tally marks? You know, are you looking to hopefully be 6-5 or 6-4, I guess, at the end of the day? And that's how it's going to be determined, is how many more people won on one side. We haven't gotten those details to see exactly how things are going to shake out at this point in the event. So I had some of those types of questions at the end of Stasis, you know, before starting the second half of, okay, you know, what is this really going to look like?
And that could be Hickman and Howard and Saturnine all playing things, you know, close to themselves, like not giving up that information. They're all playing games. Everything's a mystery.
And to that point, you know, it kind of left us, to wrap up what we saw here in Stasis, was it kind of left us with that cliffhanger before the, you know, the second half started, where, you know, ultimately we see all the champions kind of go back to their rooms at the Starlight Citadel, the calm before the storm, if you will, of we're all here now, you know, we're waiting for the fights to actually start. And when the champions of Krakoa get to their rooms, they're all greeted by essentially a little gift from Saturnine, which is the return of the tarot cards that we saw at the very beginning. And they all had kind of some different forms of foreshadowing going on.
Yeah, absolutely. I kind of like, it's interesting that this whole thing is based around tarot cards. You know, Ten of Swords is a tarot card, and its history is betrayal.
Yeah.
And but yet, they only pop up every now and then and remind you of that. You know, it's peppered in. It's not very pressing. And these little foreshadowing pieces were once again, and I took that as Saturnine just playing puppeteer.
Right.
You know, she's manipulating in any way she can manipulate.
And just as an example, so I wrote down, you know, what some of them were. So we saw, you know, Betsy gets the Nine of Swords, and it's a picture of her being stabbed by nine swords. Cables is the Fool, which he's not happy about.
Yeah.
Cypher and another one, or another person, are like embracing as the Two of Cups. Storm is seen as the card of death, leading the Dark Army, which I thought was quite interesting as a piece of foreshadowing. And, you know, ultimately they go on, and there was a piece of verbiage somewhere, or I think maybe one of the info panels, where it talked about how, you know, the tarot cards aren't always literal. So it doesn't necessarily mean that Betsy's going to die, Cypher's going to fall in love, or Storm is going to end up ruling the army. But it was really just kind of some cool little pieces that had me kind of stop on each one and think, like, okay, is this obviously telling me that somebody's going to die or not? And it's hard to say for sure, but, you know, ultimately Apocalypse wasn't too happy about the card that he saw.
Yeah, well, and immediately sees it and crumples it, you know, and I believe it's him and Genesis.
Yeah, together kind of as lovers once again. And he goes and he confronts Saturnine, you know, calling her out, what the hell is going on? And ultimately, I think at the very, very end of the issue, we finally get a face-to-face between Apocalypse and Genesis for the first time in probably millennia.
Yeah.
And that was kind of where it left us.
We'll see what happens moving forward. I mean, it could be very, very interesting.
So despite some issues being slower than others, the stakes have never been higher for the X-Men as they face the possibility of true death for the first time since forming the Nation of Krakoa. The swords have been drawn. The champions for both sides have arrived in Otherworld. Tensions are extremely high. And we will see you back here in 2 weeks to discuss what happens in the second half of the Ten of Swords event, and whether it's been good enough for us to keep following the X-Men story arcs when we break it all down in part 2. Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this chapter, be sure to hit the subscribe button to get new chapters of Geek Catch Up every 2 weeks on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, CastBox, or wherever you listen to your podcast. Be sure to follow the show on social media, and you can find us on Facebook and YouTube at Geek Ketchup Podcast, or on Twitter and Instagram at Geek Ketchup Pod. Links to all these accounts are in the show notes below and on our website, geekketchuppodcast.com. Stay saucy, you nerds.